Dr. Manly Frost Langston, surgeon, physician, and public health pioneer, is a native of Alabama who spent most of his professional career at Chattanooga or in the Tennessee Valley. He was graduated from Tulane Medical School and after brief terms of service at the Georgia State Mental Hospital in Milledgeville and Alabama's Kilby Prison at Montgomery, he joined the fledgling Tennessee Valley Authority as the first physician employed in its health and safety division. He was with the agency until 1946 when he left to enter private practice at Signal Mountain. He retired in 1973. The interview with him was recorded at the Chattanooga Hamilton County Bicentennial Public Library by Norman Bradley on May 30th, 1984 for the library's Oral History Project. Well, Dr. Langston, let's just start at the beginning. You are a native of Alabama.
Correct.
Where were you born?
Well, I was born in a little county called Bibb County, which during the Civil War became the name of Bloody Bibb. It so happens that my grandfather was a Baptist minister who served the Antioch Church in Bibb County, which was the oldest church at that time in the county and one of the older in the state. He served both slaves and owners, whites and blacks. In fact, I go back once a year to the little town of 6 Mile, Alabama, which was named 6 Mile by the Indians since their camp was 6 miles from the creek, which was their water supply. And my grandfather had 11 children. My father was one of the children. And one of his sisters, older sister, married a man named Jackson, who became a very successful farmer. In fact, he wound up with a gin, a commissary, a dairy, sharecroppers, and he in turn had 12 children. I was an only child and lived just about a mile from Uncle Henry Jackson. And in the summers, I would go back to their house, which was a big two-story house with a porch all the way around. And in the summertime, you never know how many was going to be there. You could find a place to sleep in a room or on the porch. Anyway, we still maintain that. In fact, I will return this 4th of July and share with the grandchildren and great-grandchildren the same relationship. There will be about 150 of us there.
Langston's and Jackson's.
And Jackson's. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the church is still an operating church. It has a stained glass window in the back with my grandfather's name on it. The cemetery is an interesting note there. It's wired in, and of course it's the typical tall tombstones we had in those days, and area plots. But one portion of the cemetery has no markers, and that's where the slaves are buried. They have no identification. But I was born, really and truly, in a little log house, dog trot they call it, with a kitchen and a place to eat on one side and a bedroom on the other. Of course, an outdoor facility.
What town in Bibb County now is the county seat?
Centerville.
Centerville.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which has a very good, interesting history in Alabama.
Your father was what profession did he?
My father was a merchant.
A merchant.
Yes. And he married my mother, who was named Frost. And it so happens that her mother and father were both named Frost before they married, but they could trace no relationship. He was Dutch, and she was English.
That's unusual.
It is. And so my first name is Frost, but of course I'm called Snow by a nickname for over the years, ever since grammar school. Anyway, back to my mother's father, interesting noted. He was a blacksmith, the old-time blacksmith. I've helped crank his bellows for his furnace, and I've helped him build a fire, circle fire over the steel rim for a buggy. And when the rim got so hot, he would drop the wooden portion down, and then he would quench the fire at a speed which would let you dish the wheel to a certain extent. You know, in the old buggies, they wasn't vertical with the axle. And then he moved up to the Cahaba River and developed the first water-powered service facility in the state. In fact, the coal mines of Blockton and that area there were very active at that time, and so on the river there, he would cut the timbers, the props for the mines, and sell them to the coal operators.
Where in relation to Birmingham, say, is this, Doctor?
It's almost due south. It's pretty close to Tuscaloosa.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I mentioned Tuscaloosa, one of my second cousins, a grandson of the Jacksons, is now president of the State University of Alabama.
Oh.
His name is Joab Thomas. He's been here and visited here with
In what year were you born, Doctor, so we can set...
January 12,
1898. 1898.
So I've lived in two centuries.
Do you remember anything about the turn of the century? 2 years, I don't know.
I remember very little about the turn. But my memory shortly after the turn is fairly accurate. Now, my father was a merchant. Then he moved up to Clay County, Alabama.
And his name was?
Manly Graves.
Manly Graves.
Now, where we get the name Manly, I don't know, but my first name is Manly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Clay County. And I grew up there, and from there I went to the old Howard College.
In Birmingham.
In Birmingham. East Lake. Then we moved there, and my father closed his business and went to work for good old Brown, which was a wholesale company that served dry goods and piece goods and things like that. And
what turned you to medicine?
Well, it's interesting. In World War I, which I was in, during that war, they selected from the colleges 10% to go to Fort Sheridan, Chicago. And we took intensive training there for 3 months. And then we were graduated and were commissioned as second lieutenants. We called shave tails. And I came back to Birmingham to set up a troop at this college, which we did. And I'm sure you knew Leo Record, who was a...
Yes.
He was in my troop.
Is that right?
Yes. And we had an infantry troop there at Howard College, and the flu hit. And I don't know whether you can recall the flu or not.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, you couldn't get into a hospital. Everything was full. So we had a little emergency hospital there on the campus. And we could get only one doctor to come. He would live nearby. And it was my job to assign from this company aides to work with the ones who were sick. And I signed the death warrants very often that way because they were exposed. And to show you how fast medicine has progressed, the treatment for those sick, 104 and 105 fever, was saturated solution of Epsom salts every morning and aspirin. That was all we had. But what we did, we killed those boys. We dehydrated them with this. We were flushing the poison out of the system. And so as you look back, but that's all we knew.
Losing all the liquid in the body.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, did you serve overseas, Doctor?
No. I had our duffel bag packed the night before the armistice to be shipped out to a port. And then it came through, and we were the only, you might say, soldiers in Birmingham in uniform at that time. And the streetcar line East Lake had headquarters out there with the cars, and we all went down and commandeered two streetcars and made them take us to Birmingham. Stores were open. Everything was open to us. We were the only ones there. Boy, we got more to see. And that was the end of the... We were discharged very shortly after that.
Then you attended medical school after that.
Yes. I finished Howard College, and I took chemistry. I was interested in science. And very briefly, I was a junior, and my roommate and I were from Alabama, were close friends, and we were interested in science and everything, and back in those days, somehow, I was interested in radiology and X-ray. And one afternoon after a physics lab in which we had a bunch of old junk back in a storeroom, which you never use, my roommate and I and the senior instructor were still playing around there with the equipment and everything. I had one of these old hand fluoroscopes that you could look through and see. So we drug out a step-up coil, electric coil, from the storeroom, which had two points that came across the top and you could pull and separate, and each end had insulation. We connected it up to the table, like this table here over there, and so the instructor put it together, started a spark, and I picked up the fluoroscope to put my hand for it like that, and the spark stopped. It was too far apart. I put it down to reach for those two things, and he did the same thing. He beat me to those two points, about this much. As he touched them, I grabbed him just like that. And my roommate was standing beside me over here, and he reached and pushed him back with one hand, and as he pushed back, this piece of equipment fell off and dropped out of his hands. He walked to about as far as from here to that wall, and
few
he said,
steps, just a few steps.
He did, yes.
Yes.
And he says, and I saw his hands were still, and I started to walk to him. He said, turn off the switch, but be careful, and drop dead in my arms.
Good. Now, this was the instructor.
Yeah. 30,000 volts went right through his body and his heart. Now, let's stop my electrical engineering career right there. And it wound up that I went to Tulane Medical School and enjoyed that very much. I enjoyed New Orleans. And to brief it, I have to brag a little bit. I was able to lead my class all 4 years. And with my AOA key, for me to help, it carries the inscriptions like stars and bars. So out of a class of, I think, 87 graduated, I planted the ivy that day in this building at Tulane down there.
Do you go back to 10 dead every once in a while?
I do, but they've taken it all down now and converted and everything. I have pictures of it, a few things like that. And then, of course, comes, I went to Birmingham to the Fairfield Hospital of the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company, who got that coal from up here at, what's the name of the town, just near Dunlap?
Whitwell,
yeah.
Yes.
Took my residency and internship, and I took my residency in orthopedics.
In orthopedics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lloyd Nolan was chief surgeon, and he was also with whatchamacallit in the Panama Canal Zone, and helped control the mosquitoes down there when it came, so we could build a canal.
Gorgas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And Lloyd Nolan was a real character. I'll never forget. When I graduated, I had no money at Tulane. But I had served an externship with Lloyd Nolan the year before during the summer. And so I called him up and I said, I need $100 to get my diploma and things. My mother was a dressmaker, helped me get through school. My father was making very little money as a salesman. And Lloyd sent me, Dr. Nolan, a money order for $125 and said, here it is, here's $25 to celebrate. And of course you worked for that man, you worked your heart out for him.
Of course.
So we got together, the new boys up on the hill at Fairfield, and he took us up on the roof where there was a sun parlor up there, the hospital, and he was orienting us. And we had a little house, we were going to live on the hill up there next door to the residence and everything. He said, all right now. He was always active, and he was emphasizing, all right, boys. He said, now, we'll have no drinking on this hill. But he said, if you get in trouble downtown, I'll come get you. And he was, looked down, he had a corkscrew in his hand. He said, hell, go on to work.
Well, now, From this stage in your medical training, did you go into private practice?
No.
Or with utility?
I went with the Alabama Power Company because they were building dams and steam plants. So Dr. S.R. Benedict, who was the chief of the power company in Alabama, and Dr. Nolan were good friends. And he came out and said, Dr. Langston, would you like to operate a hospital for me? It was a temporary hospital, of course. It was at Gorgas, way out in the boondocks. And, of course, young. I wasn't married at the time, but I was very much in love with a young lady from the Inslee Baptist Church, who was Young People's Director, who later went to the seminary, was my first wife, Gladys. And so I went out there. And it was so far out that the road got so narrow you couldn't turn around. And I believe if that road had been wide, I'd turn around and went back to Birmingham, but I didn't. So there was this 20-bed hospital. It was a tar picker shack, thing, you know. And so I set up shop, got my nurses and everything. And then the superintendent of the construction was not going to bring his family down from New York. He gave me his house to stay in. He knew I was planning to get married. And so the cost engineer and the head engineer and chief timekeeper and myself had bachelor quarters there for a short time. We'd go back to Birmingham on weekends and visit. And the cost engineer was a very rigorous type person. Very good athlete, could swim all day in the river, just all day. And so, and back in those wilds back there, they made all kinds of whiskey and everything back there near Jasper, Alabama. So we were going to have a fish fry one night, and so Joe Lockwood, who's, of course he's there, he was authorized to go get the home brew, or that mountain brew. He drove a little car and drove like the wind, but he drove out, and about 10 o'clock the night preceding this, my head nurse at the hospital, "Dr. Lane, come up to the hospital quick." I went up there, and this hospital was built sort of, one end was the white men, the other end was the black. And in the center was a little operating room right off the entrance right here, where I did my surgery. And I walked into the operating room. There were two strange mountaineers which I had never seen, and there was Joe Lockwood lying on my operating table, dead. So I turned to these two men. I said, "Who did it?" One of them walked over and took out of Joe Lockwood's wool shirt, packed of cigarettes, lit one right there, and said, "I did it." And there I was, two mountaineers. And I knew good and well if the other engineers in the camp got a hold of this, they'd kill those two men. So I said, "You all stay right here." And I got to camp, superintendent and sheriff. And we got those two sent over to Jasper.
Had they brought him in?
Yes, they'd brought him in, believe it or not. And they'd had an altercation. Joe was coming back, and I think Joe had sampled a little of his. He rounded a curve in the road real fast and almost ran into these boys going the other way in an old jalopy. He said, "Who in the hell do you think you are, huh? Get out of the way." And they said, they got to fighting. And so one of them just shot him right through the heart. But one sequel. Stop me if I get to.
Oh, no, that's fine. Go ahead.
Then when I did marry, and he came back, and the trial of this boy that killed Joe was held in Jasper. And he claimed self-defense that Joe pushed him back against his Ford, which the hood was off and the exhaust pipe, and was burning his back, and he shot him. But the chief timekeeper myself was sitting there, and I had saved Joe's shirt, and I thought, when I looked, if he shot him off of Joe, there'd be powder burns on that shirt. And so at recess time, Coach and I drove back to the camp, we got this shirt, and he was clean, no burns at all. And so then that was presented as evidence. And the boy was in there, saw all this happening, and they killed him. And he knew who did it, who brought the shirt in and everything. And so that shirt turned the thing, and he got life. And he was sent to Kilby Prison in Montgomery. And so then, as time went on, and I went to Montgomery to be in charge of Kilby Prison, that's the only request I made, to take this boy out of Kilby to another prison. I didn't want him in there with me. But I stayed with that until we moved to Georgia, to Milledgeville, Georgia. That's where we set up to build the Furman Shoals Dam. And we were going right along with it.
Now, this was Georgia Power Company.
Yes, but the Commonwealth and Southern was the holding company of the whole thing, see there. And construction did both of them.
Yes.
And we knew the times were tight. It's 1930. So I was there with my wife. I still had school debts and everything. And I talked to the superintendent. He went up to Atlanta to come back. He said, the number one thing they can do is just to slow us down. But on January 1, 1930, the word come down to shut up and stop everything immediately. And we did. I had six patients in the little hospital, and I transferred them all to Millersville Hospital, locked the door, left the sheets and everything on the beds. And that's when I needed the job. That's when I went to Millersville State Hospital.
Which was a mental hospital.
And the only one they had for the state. And we had about 6,000 inmates there.
Was this a rather isolated community at that point? Or how large was Milledgeville?
Milledgeville was a state capital at one time.
At one time.
Yes, it was a very antebellum proud community. A lot of old houses and everything like that, you know, and still is. Of course, they finally shifted and got the mental cases over the state, different places and everything.
At this point, this was the only mental hospital in Georgia.
Right.
And they took care of 6,000?
Had 6,000 at that time. And I guess there were about 12 or 13 of us there as doctors. And we lived the life of Riley in a way. We couldn't do anything for him. We had no drugs, no antibiotics, nothing like that. I tried to do some orthopedic repair of club toes and things and such. But the patients would urinate on the cast and pick out the sutures, so it was a pretty satisfactory job. The first time there, I think I've told you this, but the board of directors for the state, we call it the state, was a political plum. And different influential people over the state would like to be on that board, come out of Atlanta. And twice a year, the director would come to the state to inspect it and everything. And of course, we had to do everything just right at that time. You know. Anyway, this was a big old-fashioned building with keys about that long between the doors. But right in front was a big fountain with a spray on the top and had goldfish in it. So the superintendent knew they were coming the next week or shortly. He told the groundskeeper, said, clean out that goldfish bowl to pool down there. Said it's full of moss and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, Dr. Swift, where'll I put those goldfish? He said, go upstairs on the second floor, and we had these old-fashioned bathtubs in this old house, you know, great big setup. Put them in a bathtub pan in one of the rooms while you clean it out. Well, he did. And they showed up the next day, the directors did. And there was one director who was an alcoholic and who had been hospitalized for DTs. So he and his wife came in and all, you know, and so then some of the aides and all took their bags and took them up and signed him to this room where the bathtub was full of goldfish. So they came in, of course, he'd been driving a good piece and his bladder was full, so he went into the bathroom to urinate and he called his wife, said, Mary, come here. He said, do you see anything in that bathtub? She said, yes, it's full of goldfish. Thank God.
So they didn't recommit him then.
No. Anyway, I stayed there a year. And then the local town, they wanted a young doctor to come in with two of the surgeons there. And so they asked me to come in with them. I did. I still had no children. And one of these surgeons, we had a Georgia State College for Women. And they had a lot of girls there all the time. A little hospital there. This doctor, he wasn't too ethical. But these girls, they're about puberty, you know, and all, and start ovulating. They would get ovarian pain or the cramps. They'd bring them in the hospital and have, and at that time, you temperature rises about a half a degree anyway, body temperature. And he would check and decide it was appendicitis. He'd call up the family. How much of this tape should... Well, anyway, I'll tell this one. And I was his assistant, you see. I'd help him operate. He called the family and said, your daughter so-and-so has abdominal pain. I said, we think it's an appendix and we don't think we better wait. And of course, the family said, well, go ahead, doctor. And Norman, I don't know how many we opened up and the patient was just ovulating. And he would take out the normal appendix and then he would take a slice out of that ovary. It was sort of hemorrhagic, you know. And we'd sew it up. And he'd get his feet. I took that for a year and I said, no more. I resigned and came back to Birmingham, and my wife and I stayed with my parents for a short time, looking for a place to land because times were tight back in 1930. And I got my only political job, and that was prison physician at Kilby. My father was a Democrat, and he was pretty loyal. And that's where I got the 18 months penitentiary there.
Before we leave Milledgeville, just comment very briefly on the difference between the standards that were in obvious then in treatment or just care of mental patients.
Oh, in the world that we did. We had a hospital. And we had excellent nurses. We had an excellent director of nurses who has just died at 93 last year. My wife and I became very close friends with she and her husband. And we would go to St. Simon's and places. We did very little psychiatric rehabilitation. We would classify the patients, one of the biggest jobs we had, what type they had and everything. And we would treat the pneumonias and infections and those things, and would do a good job with that. We had really too many physicians who needed some work to do. But as far as what we would do, really and truly, we would have breakfast in the big room there, good food. And then we would make rounds. Each doctor would have a certain area of his care. And to go back a bit, I was the first doctor, I was the lowest doctor on the totem pole when I came. And he always got the worst end of the stick. For 2 days, another doctor took me around to show me my area and my people, my wards. And the old building was so big and ramified, you had to look out the window for trees for landmarks. And it was two-story. Well, my service included two female wards, confused, everything. One on the first floor and one on the second floor. So the third day I went by myself, and I was still sort of scared. I was young. I made the rounds, looked at the records here, and signed my book on the first floor. Then I turned and went down a hall, and in the middle of the hall was a stairway that went up the second. And at that stairway had a wooden gate that would keep the two from.
Yes.
So I had my keys. I had a whole string of them. I had turned my back in the hall to unlock that door. All of a sudden, a pair of arms came around me like this from behind. My hair stood up. I got you, honey. Well, and then by noon, we would have made rounds, and we would write letters back or cards back to the families of so-and-so and so-and-so, no change and this, that, and they'll get all that done, eat lunch, and then the afternoon was free. Had a 9-hole golf course on the grounds, and so we would play golf. And we would use young boys who were patients as caddies. I never forget one of my caddies one day. I had a little bag, not very big at that time. I think I had 5 clubs in it all.
Yeah.
And so the caddy, I lost him. I finally found him. And it was spring of the year, and these little spring daisies had come up. He had filled that bag completely full of those little daisies. And then we'd go home, and the same thing. But we did very little curative. The most of the people that we would send back would be the senile people who the judge would send. They had no other place to keep them, the county judge. We'd send them back to him, and then he'd send them back to us. But Goldberg used Milledgeville to develop the vitamin concept. It was shortly before I came that he did most of his work at Milledgeville. But
Dr. Goldberg.
Yeah.
What was
Well, we didn't know anything about the vitamins before that time. The vitamin A, B, C, and it was nutrition. He was working on that, you see. And that's
was,
where
was
the,
he head of the?
No, he was out of I've forgotten the city. I think it was Washington or New York or somewhere.
Oh, I see.
But he took this area of people as guinea pigs, you might call it, experimentation, checking blood counts before and after the use of certain nutritional elements, vitamin, and all.
Doctor, psychiatry at that point had not advanced to.
It was
point.
Asylums. It was nothing in the world, in a way. The imbecile children, and oh, they were pitiful, and the older people, and then the true psychiatric people, we kept them forever until they died. We had one there who was in the Spanish-American War, a man. He still had his puttees. He still had a jacket. And somewhere he had gotten a hold of a pistol and one of these campaign hats with a stiff brim. And he was allowed access on the grounds to walk around. And his job was to walk down to the little town about a mile, Milledgeville, to get the placards for what the movie was going to be downtown that week. They stick on a poster, you've seen it.
Yes.
And so we had one restaurant in Midland at that time, run by two Greeks, the Boston Cafe. And he'd often go in there, he'd have a dime or two and get a cup of coffee before he picked up his posters. One day he went in there, sat down at a table, and one come to wait on him. He pulled out that pistol and said, "Okay, I want service." Boy, those two Greeks went out to back. But the town was the old, and in other words, the boys' school there, and then Georgia State College for Women. And it's still about the same. Yeah. It hasn't changed much in time.
The institution has.
Yes, the institution, but the you still have levels of society there, you might say.
Yeah.
The DARs and those things, they sit way up here, and then the new people there were,
Well, then after you went to, what was the level of medical care for prisoners at Killdeer? What about, what was your experience there?
Well, I'm somewhat proud of that. I had a 50-bed hospital inside the walls, two wards. Now, we didn't have the women at this at Kilby. They were at Spigner, a little town nearby. And I had x-ray, surgery, and a good laboratory. I was the only free person in there, though. My head assistant was a white male. I have forgotten just what he was in for, but he had life. He was very proud of his ability and was excellent to work with me. And on the other side, I had a tall black man named Joe Lee Carr from Memphis who had killed a white man, but no doubt in self-defense, but he was given life. And they had set up in Memphis a reserve to where if his name ever came up for parole that they would contest it. So he couldn't get out. He was the best assistant I've ever had on surgery. I did hernias, I did appendix, I did some repair work. I recall one man, a very taciturn type person, older, in the prison, of course, we had a shirt factory and a cotton jeans and things like that, the way they were, had to work. It was from daylight, from sun up to sundown, 6 days a week, unless a doctor stopped them up. Anyway, so Joe Lee would help me, In fact, I let him do a couple of hernias himself. I'd assist him. He was good. But this white man who had the feet, I lengthened the tendons of his toes to where he could walk. He's like that, so he... As he got well, I sat on the side of his bed one morning to make it round. I said, his name was Dave Hanley. Dave, we had a language inside the prison. Would you do it again? He looked at me and thought a minute. Doc, I got it all. What would you do? I said, I would. Another prisoner, the right arm off here, the left arm off here.
Like the wrist and the elbow.
Yes.
Just about it.
He was in for rape. Stop and think a minute. How could he? I thought the same thing when I saw him. I got the true story. And he would catch a woman asleep. It's the time of the old straight razor at that time, you know, and he'd get a razor open in the crook of this arm and get on top of this woman and say, okay, cooperate or else. And she would. Of course, he won all the piety contests because he could just run his mouth like that. I have the true story of the Scottsboro case. I don't know whether I should put it into this archive or not.
Well, Doctor, whatever you choose to do.
Well, perhaps I'd better not.
Well,
I'll record this into the record. There's still controversy, both in the memory of people and also in memory of the movie that was prepared subsequent to this.
Yes.
Okay.
I see. Well, Doctor, tell me about you were talking about your medical facilities at the prison. Were the prison conditions themselves pretty good?
Yes. We had all of the male prisoners from the various counties. And?
Black and white.
Black and white,
ways.
No. We did not separate blacks and whites in the prison. By law, we could not, do we? We shared the same food, the same dining room, the same work, and everything. Of course, we had three levels of prisoners, you might say. We had the riskers, which we assigned to road camps. And then we had the trustees, which could work around the grounds, work on the farm. We had a big farm and a big dairy. And then, of course, we had the others who we had to keep incarcerated within inside the walls. And, of course, since this was the capital of Montgomery, the trustees would serve as janitors and aides and everything at the capital. And they were the grapevine, you might say, from what's going on in the outside world back into the prison. And we had drug problems at that time. In other words, we would have to check all the mail, and we would have to very carefully palpate the stamp on a letter. They could crush a morphine tablet and just moisten the circle around and stamp the letter. And then the prisoner, he could very carefully slit that with his hands, not a knife, and he had morphine. And of course, certain of the trustees would bring stuff back from down Montgomery. Sex abuse was another one of our problems. We did not segregate the old hardened so-called criminal and the young boys who were put in. And the old-timers inside would take one of these boys under his wing, so-called, and look after him. Otherwise, he might get robbed. And he was called his gal boy. And anal intercourse was rampant. And I would have to treat rectal conditions resulting from that. Had one boy, talking about, the law said from Cantor Kate 6 days a week, unless you were sick and couldn't work. And my job every morning, 6 days a week except Sunday, was to meet a line of prisoners who claimed that they were not able to work. And when I first went to Kilby, walked down the corridors and everything, while these prisoners would speak to me and give me little gifts. And I thought I was Douglas Fairbanks. I was just personality plus. Until about 2-3 weeks later, this same prisoner, when he come up to said he was sick, he'd look at me very knowingly, you know. I soon quickly learned to give to that prisoner a dime or a quarter for whatever he had to sell. So I was not obligated to him.
I guess whether you're in prison or an official, you learn the rules very quickly.
Absolutely.
I think we have to change the tape now. Excuse me.